Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. With climate, the worst-case scenario is not a risk anyone can accept. I think you know that. Disaster, some say, is not unlikely, and it may not even be far away. We may already be headed to a hothouse world, and if so, perhaps all we can hope is to slow down that wrenching change. Those are the kind of dark considerations of some very highly regarded scientists. In November, just days before the Madrid COP25 climate conference, this group published a comment in the top journal Nature. It is titled, "Climate Tipping Points, Too Risky to Bet Against." From the University of Exeter, UK, we have reached the lead author, Professor Timothy M. Lenton, director of the Global Systems Institute. Tim Lenton, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
So we call the new age the Anthropocene, but is that a new steady state where we will all be comfortable, or is it a whirlwind of change?
I think the Anthropocene is best described as the latter, a time of, at the moment, continual change, and indeed perhaps a whirlwind of change. It's certainly not a stable state. We're clearly in a transition at the moment. Now, I guess the question is, what to?
Well, to get a grip on this huge subject, I broke your concerns down into three major categories. I want to run them by you and see if we can talk about these. And so they are, number one, tipping points in unique systems, like, say, the Amazon. And number two, long-distant impacts in a chain of events following a tipping point. And then three, the global cascade, a domino effect of tipping points interacting. Does that sound like a reasonable framework for our chat?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, your comment in Nature begins with tipping points, but it doesn't end there. But to be sure we're all on board here, Tim Lenton, how do you describe a tipping point?
Well, I like to use the common example of an ordinary chair to explain to people that the world is full of systems that have different stable states. And in the case of the chair, chair upright is a stable state, but chair lying on its back is also a stable state. And if you're leaning back on the chair, you get to a point where a little bit of a nudge one way or the other is going to determine whether you're back upright or lying flat on your back. And that's the kind of tipping point in the simple case of a chair. There are lots of parts of the Earth's climate system that are a whole lot more complex than chairs, but can also exhibit different stable states and tipping points between them. So an example might be the Greenland ice sheet, where if you were to take it away under today's climate, it wouldn't regrow. And the thing that's allowing it to persist is that it's stuck 3 kilometres up in the air and the temperature's much colder up there, so that keeps the surface cold and enables the ice sheet to persist. But at some point, as you warm the ice sheet up and it starts to melt and the surface drops in altitude and that warms things up further, at some point that process that's self-amplifying becomes self-propelling and you reach a tipping point where you'd lose that ice sheet altogether. So that's one of several examples in the climate.
Yes, has the Amazon rainforest gone past a tipping point?
Let's hope not. I think at some smaller scales, we might say that the Amazon is showing signs of getting tipped, especially in the drier southeast part of the Amazon, where it's not just that people are chopping the forest down, but the recent extreme drought summers that have hit the Amazon have led to a change in fire regimes so that sometimes we're seeing bits of the forest transition away from forest to something more like a savanna. For the bulk of the forest, it's happily not tipped yet, but we know that the Amazon forest recycles its own rainfall, and that's the way in which it kind of sustains itself. But if you take out too many of the trees, especially in the wrong place, then you would kind of shut off that water recycling system, and that could doom the rest of the forest on a larger scale.
Could whole regions go past a tipping point, but we don't know it yet, even in science, so we only see them in a rear-view mirror?
Well, this is a potential problem with ice sheets and with any system that is naturally sluggish or slow. If you think about ice, it flows very, very slowly, and there's a huge bulk of ice both on Greenland, West Antarctica, and particularly East Antarctica. We think we see evidence in part of West Antarctica and a small part of East Antarctica that the ice sheets there are being destabilized. They're undergoing an accelerating retreat of glaciers. But because that's quite a sluggish system, that at the rate it's going at the moment, it will still take thousands of years, happily, for it to unfold, for the complete loss of something like the West Antarctic ice sheet. But this gets worse as the temperature goes up. So the more we warm the climate, the quicker things can unfold.
Your group, which I note includes my hero, Hans Schellenhuber, then proposes...
Yeah.
It's a great group, a lot from the Potsdam Institute and so on. They propose a long-distance impact in a chain of events following a tipping point. And I think the one that came clearest to me in your article, it would be a change in the North Atlantic current. Could you talk to us about how something that happens in one part of the Earth could affect the whole globe, possibly?
Absolutely. The crucial thing here is that the Earth and its climate is a complex but interconnected system. So what we begin to see in terms of accelerating change in the world is we see the Arctic warming up far faster than the global average, partly because the sea ice is melting, exposing a darker ocean surface that's absorbing more heat. And that amplified warming in the Arctic is contributing to the melt of the Greenland ice sheet that's also accelerating. That's adding fresh water into the North Atlantic Ocean either side of Greenland. And those are exactly the regions where deep water forms. Water from goes right from the surface of the Atlantic Ocean to the very bottom. And that's a crucial part of propelling what we call the overturning circulation of the Atlantic, that includes massive surface currents of the ocean transporting heat from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere and then across in the Gulf Stream across the Atlantic Ocean. And that's weakening that circulation, partly because of extra fresh water coming in to the North Atlantic region. And we know from the Earth's climate past, the record of that, that when you weaken that circulation, it drags the whole band of rainfall around the tropics of the planet a little bit southwards because there's less of this heat transport by the ocean. And that in turn can disrupt monsoons in West Africa, in South America where the Amazon is, around the planet in India. And when you weaken the heat transport from the south to the north, you also leave more of the heat behind in the southern ocean. And that can contribute to the melting of the ice sheets around Antarctica. So it's in that kind of physical way, through the transport of heat, moisture, momentum, that the oceans, the atmosphere, couple the planet together.
Now, is that what you mean by a global cascade? Because that sounds so risky, it's as final almost as a thermonuclear war if we get one tipping point causing other tipping points and it just goes out of control. Is that what you're discussing in the paper?
Well, we're raising the possibility that there can be, that the causal connections and interactions between what I call the tipping elements in the climate can be wired up in a way where one thing increases the likelihood of tipping another. And that does seem to be the kind of causality that I just described in the example I gave. It would require some special conditions for this to become a runaway process, like tipping the proverbial dominoes. It needs the coupling to be quite strong for tipping one thing to force the tipping of the next. But it seems to be, we think, a legitimate concern, and obviously something that we should assess carefully to get a proper handle on the amount of risk we're running with climate change. And we're particularly interested in this because we look in Earth's past and we see times when the planet was much hotter than today, with unusual temperature gradient between the equator and the pole and so on. And models that we have to model today's climate, they really struggle to reproduce these past what we'd call hothouse Earth states. But we know they existed, so we have a suspicion that there are either some of these tipping cascades or some other very strong feedbacks in the climate that can propel the whole Earth to go into a hotter state. And we've got to try and avoid that, if that's possible, to occur.
Definitely. I'd like to go back to your 2018 paper that you co-authored, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. Just a really groundbreaking shake-up paper. In figure two of that paper, it shows two possible futures for us. One is labeled stabilized Earth, and the other is hothouse Earth. It almost sounds in this new paper that we may have to give up on stabilized Earth, and our best hope is just to slow down our fall, drag it out as long as possible, heading towards hothouse Earth. Is that the way people are feeling these days?
Maybe one or two people are feeling it's that bleak. My personal view is we've still got a lot to play for, and there's still a chance we can create a stabilized Earth, but we might, at least in temperature terms, that ought to still be possible and should be something to aim for. What's unclear at the moment is whether we've made a commitment for a wet house Earth, a higher sea level, basically, because we may have already tipped the loss of some big ice sheets, even if it's unfolding slowly over thousands of years. So it might be possible to reverse that, because these are ice sheets that are melting slowly. We'd obviously have to keep things cool if we wanted to try and reverse it. So, yeah, where I'm at with it is we've got a chance to still to create a stabilized Earth, but we've clearly got some work to do to achieve that. We might still be in a situation where some of the sea level rise, albeit coming slowly, has got a certain inevitability about it.
Tim Lenton, you've studied drastic changes on this planet for a long time. You covered it in your 2011 book, Revolutions That Made the Earth. Ironically, the publisher of that, Oxford University Press, advertised that book as, quote, an antidote to the current string of depressing and apocalyptic books about climate change, end quote. But your latest paper seems pretty apocalyptic, doesn't it?
What can I say? As a scientist, you have to tell it like it is. And the more we're learning about changes happening in the climate system, and we've learned an awful lot since I published that book in 2011, which I probably finished writing a year or two before that, so it's probably 10 years out of date. I mean, I'm afraid we've learned a lot of things that support the view that the risk of tipping points in the climate is more immediate than we thought even a decade ago. I explain in Revolutions That Made the Earth, though, that the Earth has undergone these tumultuous changes before, and of course the biosphere, all life got through them, otherwise you wouldn't be here to talk about it. And interestingly, some of those past revolutionary changes of the planet are ones we kind of owe our existence to, because they involved major rises in oxygen in the atmosphere, creating an atmosphere we could breathe. But they often also involved absolutely tumultuous climate changes. And I don't think we'd be wise to sort of vote for going through one of those incredible sort of convulsions of the planet. It would be a very, very risky place to be. And that's, I guess, the kind of risks I'm trying to articulate with this latest paper. But I believe that there's still the opportunity to build, create, make a much better, brighter, more sustainable future, which has obviously got to be powered by sustainable energy sources, and it's got to be based on recycling all the materials we need to make new stuff out of the old stuff we have, just as the biosphere does. And I guess that's the kind of stark or interesting choice we've presented ourselves with now. I don't think anyone would want to voluntarily go for the climate apocalypse, but if we don't change the trajectory we're on, I'm afraid that's where we're heading. And yeah, my other work is about saying, okay, we're not going to retreat either, I don't think, in the sense of we're not going to lower global energy consumption. Well, there's no sign of that. So instead, we need a kind of way through this that's towards a sustainable energy, material recycling, flourishing future for people that doesn't wreck the planet.
Well, we'll get back to that. I want to ask you also, early in your academic life, you were inspired by the Gaia hypothesis from Britain's James Lovelock. What are your thoughts about Gaia these days?
Well, I'm still inspired by Jim Lovelock, and I helped him celebrate his 100th birthday just earlier on this year in the summer. and put on a conference to mark the occasion and to remind people to think in this way about our planet and our predicament, because I think Lovelock gave us a new worldview, a new sense of our place in the world, where other living things are an essential part of our life support system. We're all entwined together in this complex medley of feedback loops, as we call it. And I guess my thinking on Gaia now is humans collectively, we're all becoming aware of the global planetary consequences of our actions. And I think that's something new in Gaia. I don't think we'd say that any other species has had a collective awareness of the impact it was having on the whole world, even though other species like dolphins are clearly conscious. And what that offers for humans is the slim but nevertheless viable possibility that we can use our collective self-awareness to make some decisions to change the way we're acting with respect to the planet. And of course, that's the massive debate we're in now that we're talking about with regard to the Anthropocene. Are we going to change our ways because we use a bit of our foresight, if we have it, to say, well, carrying on the way we're going is going to end in disaster, so let's do things, let's preemptively change and do things differently. And for me, I call that Gaia 2.0. If humans could add a little bit of collective self-awareness to the Earth's self-regulation, then it would be adding a new kind of feedback loop into Gaia or the Earth system, one in which there was an element of conscious self-awareness and all the kind of sensing with satellites and other instruments that the business of some humans or scientists are involved in. We're involved in sensing how we're changing the world and feeding that information back to the society in the hope, possibly the vain hope, that we're beginning to collectively respond to that.
I think that's beautiful.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is Professor Tim Lenton from the University of Exeter. We are talking about the grave risk of tipping points or even slipping into a greenhouse world. In your new article in Nature, you reference a key paper, Cascading Regime Shifts Within and Across Scales, that was led by Juan Roca from Stockholm Resilience Center. How does that relate to your comment in Nature?
Well, very good question, Alex. What that is a really nice study that asks the question, well, we can see all of these possible tipping points in systems in different scales, like ecosystems, bits of the climate, what are now being called social ecological systems, like agricultural systems. That paper asked, well, can we see evidence that those tipping points, or they call them regime shifts, in those systems can interact across different types of systems and across different scales of space in particular, but also time? And they rightly identified that if you have big-scale tipping in something like the climate, then perhaps not surprisingly, that can trigger tipping down at smaller scales in ecosystems. And they, of course, also hinted that big-scale tipping in the climate might cause some tipping points or disruption in social systems. What's also worth thinking about is, can we have, perhaps only occasionally, but can we have cases where tipping at smaller scales cascades upwards to affect things at larger scales? And that could be a bad kind of tipping, but I'm also really interested in how do we now tip what I'd call positive change in social systems to avoid the bad climate tipping points. So I've taken their kind of thinking, and now I'm trying to work out, okay, where can we identify positive tipping points between humans and technology or forms of governance or whatever that are going to help us get onto a new sustainable trajectory? And also, how might we take specific systems like an ecosystem like a coral reef that might have been degraded into an undesirable state, how might we be able to tip that back into a better state with some interventions? Because I think we're going to have to do some of that to make things better again.
And then there's a paper published in PNAS in 2008, and it showed systems can appear to reach an equilibrium just before they break into a significant change of state. You and your co-author Chris Bolton wrote about that in 2015. I interviewed Chris on Radio EcoShock. So that's really another trap. Things can look very stable, just nice and calm, and then they shift radically and they never go back. That makes it hard to communicate the risks. I mean, it seems like everything's going okay right now, but it could turn bad quickly.
I know there's a certain irony in the fact that a complex system can actually become more sluggish in response to all the nudges it's getting from the world before it undergoes a really dramatic tipping point kind of change. It can be made to seem intuitive if it's possible to understand that any system with these different stable states has these mechanisms that we call feedbacks that, by definition, if it has a stable state, try to drag it back to whatever that preferred state is. But when we're seeing a system heading towards a tipping point, we're essentially seeing those stabilizing mechanisms starting to break down and get weaker. And that's why, as you're heading towards a tipping point, when you nudge a system, it actually recovers more slowly from the nudges you're giving it. And that's a signal we've successfully looked for in some past cases of approaches to abrupt climate change, for example. But it is, like all of this science of complex systems and ones involving the biosphere as well, it is inherently sometimes a little counterintuitive and interesting how these things behave. And that's, I guess, how people like me can make their living, spending 25 years of their life trying to grapple with this sometimes unintuitive complexity and then try and explain it to everybody else.
Well, it's amazing that apes can get into their brains how the whole universe works and or even try to do something like that, but we do.
We do, yeah.
Yeah. How big, Tim, do you think our remaining carbon budget is before we cross tipping points?
Well, I fear that we might have crossed one or two in the ice sheets and we're just not absolutely sure about that because it's not super easy to observe the slow dynamics unfolding in inhospitable places of the world, like around the edges of Antarctica. So we might be at a tipping point for triggering some slow ice sheet losses. I hope we're not. But if that's not the case, I think we're really running into dangerous territory if we're going towards 1.5 degrees of global warming from the current 1 degree and a bit in centigrade, that is, and the remaining budget to stay within, to try and limit the warming to 1.5 degrees, it's maybe around 400, possibly 500 billion tons of CO2, but that budget's probably being eaten away at by the fact that we're triggering some tipping point loss of carbon and the form of carbon dioxide and methane from permafrost. So the budget might well be down to 400, 300 billion tons of CO2, and we're still emitting over 40 billion tons of CO2 per year at the moment, collectively. So simple maths would suggest we're only about a decade away from expending the carbon budget for 1.5 degrees. So we may be heading into the danger zone, like it or not, in some sense. But there's still an extremely strong incentive to try to limit warming as much as we can, because the more you warm it up, the more you risk tipping other bits of the climate system.
What have you heard, Tim, about the latest climate models for the 6th IPCC report due out in 2021?
Well, I've been having a little bit of a look at this, Alex, because the major modelling groups have started to return some of their runs, as they're called, of the models into the database that we can all access. And the worrying thing that's happened is a kind of large-scale property of these models that we use to measure, we call it the climate sensitivity, the how much warmer does it get if you double the CO2 level in the model. Well, the climate sensitivity of several of the models that have returned recently has jumped up. It's gone from what used to be most of the models clustered around about 3 degrees centigrade warming for doubling CO2. Some of them have jumped up to 5 degrees centigrade or more warming for exactly the same change in CO2. And the reason they've done this is because the models have been nominally improved on the basis of some observations. So in simple terms, some satellite observations of clouds have taught climate modelers that they'd parameterize their models a little bit wrongly. They put too many ice crystals in the clouds of their models. And when you adjust that, the unfortunate consequence is you take away one of the big damping mechanisms that counteracts warming in the models. Because in the model world and in the real world, when you melt ice crystals and clouds and you turn them into lots of small water droplets, that actually makes the clouds more reflective and tends to cool the climate. But we're now saying, oh dear, there's not as much ice in the clouds as we thought there was. And that's why at least one or two of these models are suddenly showing a lot more warming when we hit them with the same CO2 change. I should also say that those models have some other issues with them. They might have some other problems. They might be not doing as good a job at capturing the recent observational changes. So those models might be wrong for another reason, and they might be wrong in a better direction. But nevertheless, it's quite concerning at the moment that we suddenly see the possibility that the climate sensitivity is higher than we thought it was, because that just makes the whole story that already sounds bad sound even worse, I'm afraid.
Well, like you, I think the rate of change may be the key. It may be the thing that we can control and our best hope. It would be great if we could slow this shift down enough to allow natural selection and evolution to help transition the species, but at our current rate, that doesn't seem like that time will be there. What do you think?
Well, certainly not for natural selection in the sense of based on genetics and population genetics. That's generally pretty slow. In the human realm, of course, we have something else which we loosely call cultural evolution. It's clear that humans are evolving far faster than evolution purely based on genetics, and instead, cultural evolution probably took hold thousands of years ago and is absolutely dominating now. And that, what I mean by that is we have these different symbolic forms and language forms in which we communicate information, and we sometimes imitate each other's behaviours and so on and so forth. So we'd like to comfort ourselves, I think, that we're a pretty adaptable species, partly because we have this cultural evolution, but of course it's the same cultural evolution in the form of the Industrial Revolution and everything else that's been driving the problem. So, and we can't deny at the same time that we're biological beings, and we've got some physiological limits to what we can tolerate. So simple things like our temperature tolerance is not going to magically evolve, and we see a real risk in these climate change model scenarios that large parts of the planet start to get to temperatures that become pretty physiologically intolerable in parts of the years in heat waves for all mammals, including humans. So, yeah, there's some basic biological constraints we're not going to evolve our way out of. But maybe there's some hope if we can perhaps change the way we're culturally evolving.
We're starting to run out of time. I'm hoping to slip in two quick questions here. The first is that you and your group of respected scientists published this warning in the journal Nature just before the COP25 climate conference in Madrid.
We did.
You called for action, not words. What is your reaction to COP25?
I didn't see a lot of action. I saw some more words. So it's the ongoing disappointment that many of us feel with the governmental and intergovernmental process on climate change. But some of us find comfort in the fact that we see action on climate change bubbling from the bottom up all over the world. We see communities mobilizing, cities clubbing together to show each other how they're creating positive change and learn from each other. So whilst the top-down process of kind of intergovernmental governance is failing us, at least the bottom-up is starting to mobilize and get some action going on this problem. We obviously need the top-down and the bottom-up both to be pushing in the same direction, though. So we need, frankly, we've got a deficit of leadership, right? And we need nations and an intergovernmental process to show real leadership on this issue, to put some human skin in the game, I think, and for some true leaders to step up. And we just have a deficit of that at the moment, in my honest view.
And where does your work go from here, Tim?
Well, I would really like to focus a bit more of my energy on how can we tip positive change to avoid the really bad climate tipping points. I think the problem for someone like me, trained as a scientist, as an environmental scientist, is we're so used to diagnosing the problem, and we're getting spectacularly good at diagnosing the problem and telling everybody else about it. But what the world's crying out for now, I think, is probably a roadmap.